time to talk finance, and the team from IT aren't available tonight, so we've got Jorge and Carlos from Mossack Fonseca. No, only joking. Only joking. Here we go.
The topics discussed here tonight are general in nature, and you should seek personal advice before acting on any of this information. And now, on 2GB 873, The Bottom Line. Thanks to IT Financial Services. High-quality financial planning. Visit itfs.com.au.
Only joking. Carly Tonkinson and Philip Tafe from IT Financial Services. Good morning to you both.
Good
nice
morning.
To have you back.
Thank you.
Have a nice Easter break.
Very nice.
Financial planning's in the news, isn't it, with this Panama or Panamian or however you say it group?
Yes, yeah. It's hitting all the news this week, and I think it will do so for many weeks to come. There's millions of documents to get through, apparently. So, financial planning is at the heart of it because it is setting up these offshore companies for mainly taxation benefits, but all about structuring things to improve your tax situation.
This is this mob called Mossack Fonseca. Now, just before we go into the things that we normally talk about, people see this story, oh, rich people putting money into offshore accounts. It's not technically illegal, is it? But some of the individuals using this have gained their money in an inappropriate manner, and also you can use these shelf companies in an illegal manner. It's all about nuance, really, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So some of the issue is that even if the people setting up the offshore companies weren't doing anything illegal, potentially just the way that it looks. So we're seeing that with a lot of heads of state, so particularly in China, Russia, Iceland is another big one at the moment. But then also, people who, potentially with money laundering and things like that. There are systems in place to prevent these people setting up these financial structures, certainly to prevent them getting international finance arranged. But it looks like the due diligence may not have been done in a lot of these cases, and details are coming forward now.
Okay, now, of course, Carly and Philip here from IT Financial Services. Any questions you have about your personal finance? It might be superannuation, it might be pension related, it might be something to do with the stock market. Property, of course, so whatever that it is that you need a little clarity and clarification on. 131873 is the open line number. To both of you, to both Carly and Philip, before we go to calls, the issue of becoming a part-time retiree, transition to retirement, I suppose, all of these sort of issues, there's got to be a lot of questions in people's minds about this process, doesn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And you can make some big mistakes if you don't set things up correctly. So one big mistake I think I see some people doing is, because there's a lot of talk about transition to retirement pensions, and once you hit, 55-odd years of age, you can start drawing an income out of your super fund. But by doing that, what you effectively do is, I guess, you cap what you can take out of your fund at 10%. And a lot of people may have some money in their accounts that's called unrestricted non-preserved money, which you can actually take out as a lump sum if you want to. Whereas once, if you use that money to start up a pension from your super, you can't actually get your hands on that money as a lump sum. So that's just one thing where, if you didn't get some advice and, really know about how the components inside super work, you could end up actually limiting yourself rather than taking advantage of the system to its full. And then there are a lot of other things that people just aren't aware of. I just mentioned that at 55, you might be able to access your super in that way, but ages are changing, I guess. Everybody's different. I had some clients in this week who thought they could access their money at 55, and it turns out it's 56 and 57 for husband and wife. So that can really change your plans if you've been sitting at home thinking, yep, when I hit 55, I can get my hands on money and let's plan around that. And then to find out that it might be 2 years away or even up to 5 years away. So, there are a lot of those little rules that if it's not your day job, you're not going to be aware of them, and it's well worth getting some advice to check it out.
The other thing a lot of people forget is to apply for the seniors card, which is that's actually a New South Wales benefit. So that would be applying for that through the New South Wales government. And that's the one that gives you the cheap transport, so the $2.50 concession all-day transport and a lot of other discounts, entertainment discounts and things like that.
And so that is just age-based, isn't it? That's not to do with your financial position.
Not financial, but hours of work. So you need to be over the age of 60 and working less than 20 hours a week. But if you are dropping back your work, definitely consider going on and applying for that.
Okay. 131873 is the number. We'll explore all of that a little further in a second, but I've got some questions here. Leslie, good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Yes, Leslie.
Sorry about the old brain. What is the name of your guest?
It's Carly and Philip. There's two of them this evening.
Okay, young people.
That's you guys. Fire away, Leslie.
Speak for yourself, Michael.
Right. Yeah. I'm a pensioner, and I inherited a house in Five Dock. The front bit was built in 1923. It has no problems. There's an extension at the back that was built in 1956. It's a load of rubbish. Now, virtuously, I have taken out a reverse mortgage to fund repairs. Mm-hmm. I already spent $23,000 on the plumbing, and it's all underground.
Okay.
I mean, I can point downward and say there's some very expensive plumbing down there. Anyway, now, my mortgage, called the Equity Unlock Loan for Seniors, is with the Commonwealth Bank.
Right.
And my faith in that institution has really dropped out the bottom. You know, their financial planners were, you know, made many mistakes and caused people misery.
Yep.
I've even got the house insured with ComInsure.
Right.
What's the particular question, though, with all this, Leslie?
The question is, I'm totally, you know, how much of this can I switch away from the Commonwealth Bank, in which I think, I mean, how can I trust them to deal with the mortgage, with the reverse mortgage, when the time comes to drop dead or sell the place?
Yeah, look, Leslie, I mean, you raise a good point. It's very difficult once you lose trust in an institution. Look, you could certainly look around and try and refinance the reverse mortgage, so approach a few other providers and see if they'd be willing to refinance that for you.
It comes down to getting a second opinion. You know, when you're shopping around for a big, I guess it's a huge expense item like that.
I know.
It always pays to get a second opinion, and I think where people fall into a trap is they set up these arrangements and then never bother to review them. And the reality is the market's always changing, products are always being developed that might work out better off. Yeah, absolutely, I think you should get some advice, and, you know, on the loan, that might be a mortgage broker to shop around. And obviously you have to weigh up the costs, because there's no point in moving.
I know it would cost. I mean, in a sense, I'm just cranky as a bag of cats and would love to know, you know, I would love to spit in their eye.
Well, the best way to do that would be to shop around.
Oh, I know.
Thought you were going to say go to the office and one-on-one.
Don't encourage that.
Before I took this out, what I did was to inquire from the younger generation who are competent in these things, and they shopped around for me. And in the end, they said, this was at this stage, you know, you might as well stick with the banks. So I stuck with the one I was in anyway. But, you know, since then, I had faith at that stage. But
Leslie, that may very well be the outcome. You know, it just may not make sense to change the arrangements, but at very least look at what the alternatives are, and you might find that there are actually some significant cost savings or savings on the interest rate that can be achieved.
How easy is it for someone like Leslie, who might have, say, the reverse mortgage with the Commonwealth Bank, they've always banked with the Commonwealth Bank, hypothetically, how is it for them to then just switch that reverse mortgage to someone else? Can you do it? It seems difficult.
No, you could definitely refinance. That wouldn't be an issue. It's just tedious. I mean, you've got to fill in all the applications. If you haven't banked with the institution before, you've got all the ID requirements. But look, Leslie's also, as she said, she's got her insurance there as well. She's got a bit of buying power. Definitely shop around. You know, you've got the potential there. You could bring over your insurance business, your mortgage, and hopefully negotiate a good deal.
Because hypothetically you wanted to swap the provider of your reverse mortgage, if we can put it that way, would you not have to pay the original back the money you've technically borrowed and then refinance?
No, the banks would sort that out amongst themselves, so the new provider would pay out the old loan and go from there, just the same as if you do your own mortgage.
All right. Leslie, thank you for the call. 131-873 is the open line number. On that issue of reverse mortgages, I mean, they are becoming more popular as a lot of people realise that you know, what only, say, 15 years ago was an average sort of priced house is now worth $2 million or something. I mean, yeah. Takes suburbs like Roselle and these sort of things, you know, pretty small places, but, you know, every brick's worth about $45,000. You know, are there some traps for, well, I was going to say young players in this? Not so young players.
Yeah, there is. So things like if you take out a reverse mortgage and put the whole lump sum that you access into your bank account, it can reduce your age pension. So don't take out more than what you need. And make sure it is you know, something that you genuinely need. Don't just take it out for the sake of it or to, you know, potentially lend to family and things like that. It should be for your own income needs. But there's a lot of protections in place now that weren't there. So they did have a bit of a bad name where the loans started to be worth more than what the properties were. The amount they'll actually lend now is a lot less and a lot of protections are in place. So I think they're a really good option for people as asset rich, cash poor. Leslie's example where you need money to maintain the property is a great one.
I guess keep in mind as well, the banks don't want to lend money so that the loan ends up being worth more than the home.
I was going to ask about that. I mean, this is all well and good in a booming property market, but traps for the borrower is one thing, traps for the banks and other things.
Hugely.
You take out $1 million, it's worth $1 million today, but we have a property downturn over the next 10 days, and it's worth $800,000 when you die.
The cap's around about 20%, though, that you can actually access as a reverse mortgage. You can't access...
You can't take the entire sum of the value.
Even close. So, yeah.
And there are age restrictions, too, so they're not going to let a 40-year-old take out a reverse mortgage. You know, I think you normally have to be over 60, 65. It's different for different lenders. But they're obviously trying to protect themselves, and they've got their actuaries and people running the numbers, working out how long you're going to live and how much they can afford to lend against a property. So you'd hope that they get the numbers right because it's not in their interests either to have it not work.
Mm.
But definitely I would treat them as a last resort. If you've got any other funds available to you, use those first. But I do think these are a great backstop for people, you know, when you're down to your last cent and you just need some of that freedom.
If you're asset rich, cash poor, as so many people are. 131-873, g'day Richard.
Yes, good morning. My wife and I are retired in our mid-70s and we have allocated pensions which have been affected by downturns in the market. And I wanted to ask you about the relative merits of allocated pensions and annuities and would I be better off in annuities?
Okay. Richard, with the allocated pension, there's some definite merits there. The ability to choose what you're investing in is an advantage, although at times like this, if you're invested in shares, you will notice the downturn. But you've also got flexibility over the income and the ability to make lump sum withdrawals whenever you like.
Yes, that's right.
Whereas you do lose a lot of that flexibility with an annuity. Also, yes, the share market has been experiencing some downturns, but the cash rates have been very low for several years, not looking to be increased anytime soon. So you'll be moving across to a pretty low-returning sector by going into an annuity as well.
Okay.
So you could just be jumping out of the frying pan into the fire. As long as your pension is structured correctly, as long as you've got enough cash there to keep your income payments up, and you've got that time to let these investments recover, the short and medium-term market performance shouldn't really impact your decision. You don't want to be selling out at the worst possible time.
Oh, okay. Well, I was anticipating that information, and I appreciate the merits of that argument, yes. So I do understand that.
The other thing to keep in mind, Richard, is that inside your allocated pension, you can probably invest in things that will give you a similar outcome to what an annuity would. So, for example, if you just put the money in a series of term deposits and you could have some quite long-dated term deposits inside the allocated pension, you know, you're pretty much locking in a return there, but maybe giving yourself a little more flexibility to access lump sums if you need to.
Oh, okay. Righto.
A lot of that then comes down to which allocated pension are you in, what are the investment options, and do you have that kind of choice and flexibility? And that's where it can then boil down to, I guess, reviewing your whole structure and are you in the right super fund?
Mm-hmm. All right. That puts me in the picture. I appreciate the merits of that advice.
Thanks a lot for the call, Richard.
Thank you, Richard, for calling. 21 past 12, 131873. Take a break. 131873. Any questions of a personal financial nature? Of course, open line after 1 o'clock, but in this first hour, every Tuesday morning, except I think the Easter weekend, Carly and Philip here from IT Financial Services, here to help you. 131873. G'day, Dennis.
Yes, hello, how are you going?
Good, thank you.
Look, I was just listening to that lady talking before, and I didn't know her full circumstances. But one of the things you don't hear a lot about is the pension loan scheme, which is run by Centrelink,
mm-hmm.
and people who are eligible for the pension, even if they're only eligible for $1 or $2, can access the pension loan scheme, which brings their income up to the full pension. The current interest rate is 5%.
Right, yep.
And you're aware of that?
I think, yeah, it's 5.25, I think, at the moment.
Exactly right.
Anyway, but I didn't know it was actually... I thought the eligibility criteria was not eligible for the pension. But, yeah, I mean, look, we can certainly look into that.
Yeah.
I guess, I mean, the issue with that is even though you may bring up your fortnightly income, it's where you need those big lump sums, and that's where people would look towards a reverse mortgage. So where Leslie was spending...
She'd spent $23,000 already and looking...
Some beautiful plumbing. To access those lump sums, the pension loan scheme would probably not be the way to go there.
It's a very undersubscribed scheme. There's very, very few people on it. Probably in the 10, 20,000, I believe.
Mm.
And it just means that if you've got an asset that you can actually just borrow against that asset at a pretty low interest rate, but only up to the limit of the pension, of course.
Yeah, so I'm just having a look. Yeah, if you do qualify for the maximum age pension, you can't get anything. So, yeah, you only bring up your income to that maximum age pension.
I think it's more suitable for people that can access a very low level of pension, but then can supplement their income up to the maximum pension.
Yeah, although to me, Dennis, probably the reason it's underused that if you've got assets to such a level where you're getting a reduced age pension, do you actually need to make use of the pension loan scheme at all?
Yeah,
or would you use your own money as opposed to start paying an interest rate?
Yeah.
So I'd say that's why it's not utilised.
Yeah, exactly right. I just think, I know a few people who have accessed it, and they're pretty happy with it, actually.
Yeah, fantastic. And it's one of those things that, if it's right for the person at the time, and it's good to be aware of all those things. So we appreciate the call.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dennis. So thanks for the idea. 131873, 26 past 12. Good morning, Anne.
Oh, good morning. And I hope everybody's very well.
Very well, thank you, Anne. And you?
Good, thank you. I'm just curious, it's probably... a trivial question, but exchange-traded funds, I think, in Australia, it's a good way of hedging your bets rather than being, traumatised by or keeping awake at night wondering if I'm in the right things and so forth, etc. I was wondering about exchange-traded funds, say, international, such America, their market would be much, much, much bigger than ours, where ours is a very small market.
Mm.
What's your thoughts about being in such a thing?
Just quickly, I guess, for other listeners, Anne, an exchange-traded fund is it's like a managed fund, so it's a parcel of shares, but it's traded on the stock exchange. So you can buy shares in the US market as a whole or shares in the Australian market, European market. You can buy shares in... small companies. There's a whole range of different parcels of shares you can buy. So they're a really effective way of getting a lot of diversification, so a lot of different shares, and also quite an economical way to hold those investments. As you say, you can pick ones that are Australian or ones that are international based.
And they generally track an index. So an exchange-traded fund isn't looking to try and do better than what a share market is doing. So if you pick the US... some kind of US index, the United States share market does well, so will the exchange-traded fund. And if it does poorly, well, its objective, I guess, is to match that and do equally as poorly. So they definitely have some merits because they're a very low-cost way of getting exposure to all those different markets around the world. What a lot of fund managers would say is that, but why do you want to invest in an index, if you think it might go down, you pay a little extra and invest via a managed fund where you're getting somebody's expertise to not invest in the bad companies and just pick the good ones. So I definitely think they have merit, but perhaps blended with a more active approach so that you get the best of both worlds inside a portfolio.
All right. What I was curious about was, okay, in Australia, our ETF would be quite small, whereas, say, America would be much larger. Mm. Would you have more chance over there? Or, you know, or is it worth investing over in one of those in America, say, just because you've got that big, broad spectrum of markets?
Well, and
then,
have...
and then would you have to do, you'd have to hedging, you know, for your international currencies?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a few different points you raised there. You would definitely have more stocks, so more individual stocks in larger markets such as the US, but that doesn't mean that the performance will be any better. Really, it's about how well the Australian market performs as a whole versus how well the US market, for example, would perform as a whole. And you're right, look, some of those US exchange-traded funds have billions of dollars under management, so the size is quite significant. Depending on what your investment objective is, you know, you should always try and diversify a little bit. Just having everything in Australian is obviously a greater risk as well. And then, yeah, of course, investing internationally does bring that extra risk of what the currency will do.
And also understanding how the particular exchange-traded fund that you've chosen works. They are all very different, and I mean, there are iShares, Vanguard offers a lot of exchange-traded funds, but they're all supported in different ways, and what that causes is, you know, different liquidity in that exchange-traded fund, which I guess means how difficult it is to get in or out, or what cost you pay to get in and out.
Mm-hmm.
So you really want to understand how the exchange-traded fund operates internally. And our research department actually just brought out a big paper on exactly this last week. So if you're interested, you might want to give our office a call during the week, and we'll be able to give you quite a bit of detail and analysis on the different options across not just international but all the Australian ones as well.
All right. Well, thank you for that. Just it's hard because there's a lot of things to think about, you know, diversification and correlation. You don't want everything to be correlated as well. So there's just an awful lot to get your head around.
Oh, it's huge. I guess it's just like constructing any portfolio, and an exchange-traded fund might be one part of that, but then there are going to be a dozen others that you need to consider on top.
That's true. Well, thank you very much for your time, and I'll be definitely in touch with you.
Great. We'll give out the number later on.
Thank you.
We will do. Thank you, Anne, for the call. Much appreciated. 131873 is the number. We will take a quick break and back with more in a moment. If you've got a question, 131873 is the number. Talking finance in this first hour with the team from IT Financial Services. Now, understanding where you are financially can be daunting without IT Financial Services. They demystify financial jargon, provide clarity to your goals and aspirations, and they'll help you to develop your financial blueprint to work towards your lifestyle objectives. Now, from financial lifestyle coaching, financial risk profiling, strategies and investments, to real-life financial solutions, just make one call to IT Financial Services on 9258 7500. That's 9258 7500, or go online, itfs.com.au, and if you didn't get the number down, get a pen, we'll tell you again later what the number is. IT Financial Services, Australia's own high-quality financial planning company. They could make a real difference to your financial future. IT Financial Services, call them. 9258 7500. Andre, hello.
Yes, Mike.
Yes.
Could they tell me why you can't get a reverse mortgage on a terrace house?
Yeah, so it wouldn't be all terrace houses, but the banks will certainly assess the type of property and decide whether or not they consider that a good bet mm-hmm. as far as lending goes. So depending on where it's located, the size of the terrace house, what's you know, the type of ownership, it may be difficult to get, you know, even an ordinary mortgage, let alone a reverse mortgage, on certain types of properties.
Yeah, studios and I think one-bedroom apartments in the city are often targeted. Well, not really targeted, but the banks aren't particularly willing to lend against them.
Oh, what, in the city in that?
one smaller apartments closer to the city, so where you have those ultra-small apartments, banks can get a little bit nervous about that. I know that, look, certain banks are certainly more lenient than others, so if your friend has contacted one bank and has been told no, it's definitely worth contacting at least the other major banks and just seeing if they would be willing to consider that.
Oh, right, so if one place is refused, it doesn't mean that they're all going.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's where you might be better off dealing with a mortgage broker, because it could save you a lot of time rather than calling around to, you know, dozens of different lenders.
Oh, right, so deal with a mortgage broker. And where do you contact a mortgage broker?
Good question. You could contact our office. We can put you in touch with somebody.
Oh, good. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Andre.
Okay, Andre, thank you. So why is it that the banks don't particularly like some forms of, I think you're talking about studio apartments and things, eh?
It's just what they consider the property growth will be like, so and also the speed at which it can be sold. So if they consider the property may not be sold very quickly, or it's got a very limited market to market to, they just consider it more risky and don't want to lend against it.
Mm-hmm.
Another issue we have in the Australian market as well is because you've got these big four banks dominating the market, they also don't want to take on too much risk in one particular property. So you have these new developments where you may, you know, try and get a loan for an apartment in a new development. If it gets to the end of the development and you go back to the bank to get the final payment, if your bank's already lent, you know, 30% of the building, they're not going to fulfil that loan because they don't want too much exposure to one building.
Mm.
So you need to be really careful, particularly on these off-the-plan ones, because that's a big risk in Australia with such a small market.
Okay. Now, it's something a little different from property. I mean, we obviously have had a fairly poor start to the financial year, well, certainly to the year to date as of January the 1st. Some people would see it as doom and gloom, but glass half full for a second. I mean, what are the advantages of a poorly performing market?
Yeah, so certainly one thing that we've been looking at with clients over the past few months are for people who want to do things like move shares into their super fund or something like that. So if you're looking at doing that in a lower market, you can really minimise the amount of tax that you might have to pay to move assets into super. So if something that you're looking at, you know, certainly over the next few years is to start moving some of those personally held shares into super in preparation for your retirement, now's definitely a good time to start reviewing that strategy. You've also got issues such as if you're trying to get a lot of, you know, new investment happening. So say you've sold an investment property and you're buying shares. Again, a good opportunity to start adding that portfolio in at a really low price point. The other thing I see, you know, I guess it is very much looking at a glass half full, but it's a really good opportunity to see whether your strategy is in order, because in a poorly performing market, you don't have that sense of optimism where everything's great, and you know, a good market will hide a lot of problems, whereas a poorly performing market will really identify issues in your portfolio, such as, you know, you don't have enough cash, or your investments are in the wrong type of investments if you need income or something like that. So it's a really good opportunity to look at your investments and say, is it right? Because a good portfolio should work in a bad market as well as a good market. I'm not necessarily saying that you'd get great returns in a bad market, but it would certainly hold its own and you'd certainly be able to see it through.
Live to fight another day, basically.
Yes.
But the way people tend to have their money set aside, particularly for super, is through a default fund, and that just rides the blue chips, basically, doesn't it? The ASX 200. And so if that's down, you're down. Really, I mean, it's not really like Warren Buffett, is it, where there's a huge amount of research going into particulars and picking win. I mean,
don't
a lot of people just ride the banks and the miners?
Oh, a lot of those diversified funds, no, there'd be huge amounts of research going into it. And that's where your fees come from, you know. And a lot of people who are just chasing lower fees, what they're really having to accept is probably what you're talking about, which is less activity, not as many people looking at it day to day and trading on the particular investments. Because fund managers often come to us and say to us, well, how much are you willing to spend? If you're willing to spend more, go for this fund because it's really active and we've got all these options that we can give you access to. But if you're just wanting to be cheap, well, okay, then we need to look at things like exchange traded funds, which I think one of our previous callers was asking about.
Yes.
So it just like everything else in life, you kind of get what you pay for. What Carly's talking about, though, I guess, is making sure that what you're paying for is actually working in the way that it's promoted. And when the market's down, it's the acid test that, is it going according to plan? For most people who are adding to their super, though, who aren't thinking about the particular investments and they're just drip-feeding money in every time their employer makes a payment, the market being down is not really of any great concern because it means you're buying in at a lower price. And if you're holding onto your super for the next 10, 20, 30 years, eventually that's going to turn the corner and you're going to do quite well out of the fact that you're buying in now while things are weak. I'm always surprised when share markets are down, all the news is pessimistic, and people will always contact me about, I think I should be selling. You know, it all looks terrible. And yet the share market then goes up 5 or 10%, and those people never call. It's this, I guess, fear of everything melting down and things being different this time, whereas people really have to try and hold their nerve. And when all the news is bad, that's the time where you really need to just try and not read the newspaper or listen to shows like us talking about how bad things are.
Yes, okay, that's interesting advice.
I think where you mentioned those like default funds, I think that's another opportunity that we see at the moment, because those default funds for a lot of employer funds, they're balanced funds or diversified funds, and they've probably got at least 30% cash or fixed interest type investments in there. Mm. And for someone like you, Michael, there's no way you want 30% of your super sitting in cash when it's, you know, as Philip said, it's there for a long time.
Well, you don't know. I might be getting out of here in a year. You never...
Well, you're still not allowed to take it.
I still can't get your super.
Won't be my choice. But yes.
So for a lot of people, if you're sitting there in those default funds or these balanced funds where you've got a really long time horizon ahead of you, use now as a time to look
aggressive
at switching across, because, again, it's a really good time to be buying into those aggressive shares and out of that cash profile.
And the other comment I get is from retirees who say, yeah, but, you know, I'm not working anymore. I can't afford to talk about investments in this way. Whereas the reality is they can if it's structured properly. You know, that set aside enough money to give themselves the protection and the buffer so that the remainder of the funds can be invested. And, you know, in times like these when markets are down, maybe use a little bit of their surplus cash to take advantage. So it may not be to the same extent as a younger person would, but absolutely, retirement doesn't mean that you're out of the game.
Self-managed super funds, more and more people into those, and as the stock market looks a little wobbly, people do get creative, as you know, because you would get phone calls from people saying, what about this, what about that? A couple of scenarios. If someone wants to invest in, say, jewellery, stones, these sort of things, can they put them in a self-managed super fund?
Potentially they could. It would have to be very strictly an investment. So it couldn't be jewellery that your wife happens to wear to the opera. It couldn't be on display anywhere. You can't lend it to a museum and, you know, have your name on a little plaque. You know, none of that. It needs to be pretty much locked in a vault, strictly investment purposes. I mean, that's really the test for any investment you want to put in super. It needs to be strictly an investment, no personal involvement whatsoever.
What about people buying into a racehorse? I suppose it's okay as long as it never races, right? Which is a dud investment. Is that the case? As long as it's locked up in McDonald's farm?
Yeah, I'm not sure. That's a really interesting question. I'm surprised I've never come across that before, a racehorse.
Me
because
too.
The racehorse, I mean, it would be difficult to argue you get
a lot of people
personal...
think, gee, that's a good money. You know, if Knackety Lad or whatever gets up, then woohoo, we're in the money, you know.
I could understand if perhaps it was a breeding business or something like that that your super fund was investing into, but... actually just racing the horse and hoping that you win prize money.
Because I guess the theory, I know I'm putting you on the spot here, but the theory would be, okay, well, as far as I'm aware, correct me if I'm wrong, if you buy a expensive artwork, you can't display that in your hallway if it's bought through your super fund. It's got to be in a storage facility, a specially designed one. As you say, if you buy a stonker of an emerald that, you know, Elizabeth Taylor once got from Richard Burton, then you can't wear that to the opera. That's got to be in a vault. But if you buy into a racehorse, I guess the theory would, the scenario would extend, it can't sort
can't
of participate.
Race, I guess, yeah. The other thing, I guess, is a
racehorse. I'm going to get back to you
is,
on that next week, though.
Well,
we're
I would
going to check it out.
If it is a hobby, your winnings aren't taxable.
Mm.
And if you, what's the point of putting it in super? Because any income the super gets would pay a flat 15% tax. So to me, actually, it would be a disadvantage to hold. I mean, I don't see an advantage of a racehorse in super, really. Given that winnings aren't taxable.
You're saying just have it in your own name.
I'm not recommending anybody goes out and buys racehorses.
Well, Some people have done quite well out of that.
And some people have not.
And many have not. Yes, indeed. All right. It's a quarter to 1-131-873. Any personal finance questions you might have about your racehorses or indeed anything else, 1-131-873. Be back in a sec. Talking personal finance, of course, with IT Financial Services. Any questions? 131-873. They're here for another 14 minutes or so, so take advantage of it. Let's look at the age pension, fellas. Planning for the 1st of January 2017 changes. What changes are coming? Why should they plan?
So some major changes to the age pension. The estimate is about 300,000 people will either lose some benefits or all benefits come the 1st of January. So it's going to be a fairly sweeping change. The change is basically to the assets test. So at the moment, a couple can have about $1.15 million aside from their family home in financial assets and still get some age pension. And that's going to cut back to about $850,000.
Which, all things being equal, I mean, without getting political, that sounds reasonable to me.
It definitely does. It actually brings it back into line with where it was back in 2007. So I think it was then Costello who basically doubled the assets test taper rate. So, we at that time saw a lot of more people become eligible. Now we're going to see a lot of people lose those benefits. The losses for those people with around about, let's say you've got about $860,000, say, and you lose the pension, you're probably looking at losing about $13,000 a year for a couple. So it's still a bit of money. So if you're planning, really what you have to plan is, number one, can you look at bringing forward any expenses that may help you keep the age pension? But number two, if you just can't keep the age pension, if you are $200,000 over the new limit, don't go off and spend $200,000 just for the sake of it.
I was going to say, how many people are going to see this and say, you know what, I've always wanted to extend the house.
Yep.
And do it in Carrara marble and go for it. I mean,
a lot.
But it's not that smart, is it, really? I mean, your quality of life surely would drop because the pension won't make up that money.
It's not going to make up that money. You're much better having the money yourself and being in control of it. So if that's going to be the case, the best thing you can do is just look at your other investments and make sure that you're ready to top up your income from your own money again once you lose that pension. So it is the 1st of January. It's fast approaching, really. So everybody should be looking at, number one, will they be eligible? If you think you're going to be $5,000 over, then maybe prepaying a holiday or something like that's worth it. Also worth saying that the people who do lose the age pension will go over to the healthcare card, so you'll still maintain a lot of the healthcare benefits that the pension has attached.
I have had a lot of inquiries from people asking about gifting money, though. You know, can I give away that $200,000 to keep myself under the limit?
To the next generation, really.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that doesn't work either. Well, maybe 5 years down the track, it might have some benefit, because as the rule stands, you can only give away $30,000 over 5 years, but it's actually $10,000 each year up to $30,000 over 5 years. If you give away more than that, you're more than welcome to. And this is another trap people fall into. They think there's this gifting rule, so I can only give away $10,000 this year. Well, no, you can give away as much as you want. It's just that Centrelink will still assume that anything above the $10,000 is yours and not increase your age pension as a result of the gift.
So what if it's Christmas, you know, and there's a nice little envelope on the tree and some people get tickets to
with
things.
With your name on it.
But, yeah, there's a lot of zeros behind that one. That still counts, even though it's a Christmas present?
It's gifting, yeah.
It's gifting.
Yeah. So, and you can see why they do it. Otherwise, you would just move your assets across to kids, get the age pension, and the kids would sort of backhand the money back to you. So it's a good... yeah, I think the rule is quite reasonable. And again, if you can afford to give away $200,000, then do you really need to be relying on a government-funded age pension?
That's it. That's the point, isn't it? Yeah. But there are obviously, as you say, a lot of people calling up saying, look, I hear this is coming in 8 months or 9 months' time. I want to prepare. What should I do?
What can I do? Yeah. There used to be so many more things that you could do. There were our previous caller tonight was asking about annuities. And once upon a time, you could put money into an annuity and it wasn't counted as an asset by Centrelink. So they were hugely popular because obviously you could have quite a lot of money, hide it away and still get some age pension. And then over the years, that's just all been clamped down on and no longer exists. So your opportunities to minimize your assets are actually quite limited. A big one is for any husband and wife who have quite an age difference. So let's say the husband's older, hits age pension age sooner, then putting money into the wife's super fund can actually hide it as an asset until she reaches age pension age. So that's probably one of the biggest things, but it only works for, I guess, a limited number of people.
And now they're looking at reducing the amount, the co-contribution rate anyway, so you'd be limited to potentially $10,000 a year, wouldn't you?
No, so that's not a...
Super splitting, yeah, so not super splitting. You can actually withdraw the money out of your super if you're eligible, and your wife can put it in her super fund as a contribution, as a personal contribution. So $540,000 in one go, potentially.
Right.
But yeah, you've only got those few years. As soon as she hits age pension age, it will then be assessable and likely to lose the benefit.
And so you can't even funnel it all through Panama anymore either. I mean, you know, everything's being clamped down. What's the point of working hard, eh? 131873. Hi, Will.
Oh, good morning, guys. I've just got a question regarding to the saving account, like the term deposit. And look, at the moment I've got an online saving account. I'm earning very, very little interest rate at the moment, between 2.5% to 3%. I'm just wondering, is any other alternative, like a compound interest or high interest saving sort of option that you would recommend?
Yeah, look, if you are purely looking at something that's very secure, like cash, you know, bank accounts and term deposits are really your safest bet. I'm starting to see term deposit rates around that 6 month mark go up a little bit. So, you know, you can certainly get more than 3%. Depending on how much you've got to put in. But looking around online, so websites such as CanStar, for example, will publish term deposit rates and online banking rates across all the different institutions. So that's a good way to look around without having to go into each of the branches. But beyond that, if you are looking for more return, you know, consider whether or not that cash and term deposit type investment is really what you're looking for, or are you potentially... better off looking at other types of investments, such as high dividend paying shares, for example, that would get you a better return in the longer term.
What about compound interest? Do they, like the bank, ever pay compound interest on a saving?
They normally cap. I mean, you have to look at each account because they're all different. But often what you'll see, and Carly mentioned that website, CanStar, and there'll be little symbols beside each of the accounts letting you know, is the interest calculated daily? And effectively, that is what compounding interest is. You know, it's calculated every single day, added to your account, and then you earn more interest on that combined amount the next day. So, yeah, you want to see, is the interest paid daily, or is it being paid monthly or quarterly, or just at the end of the term deposit that you take out? And if it's being calculated daily, then... you're okay. Some of them say calculated daily but paid monthly and things like that. So, different for every account. And with term deposits and bank accounts, generally those online savings accounts can pay a slightly higher rate than term deposits out there. But a lot of them have terms around it, so you might need to be adding a certain amount every month and making no withdrawals and all the rest.
Yeah.
And the trap a lot of people fall into, and the banks know this, is that most people at some point make a withdrawal, lose the interest in that month, and then the whole exercise wasn't really worth it.
Well, bonus periods is a really common one now, where the rate might be great for 3 months but then terrible. And again, the banks will count on you not shopping around. Once you've got it in place, you might leave it there for six months, 9 months, earning 0.5%. I've seen a lot of cases where people would have been better off not doing anything, it just for the fact that they go for the bonus interest but then don't think to change it again, and end up worse off than they would have been otherwise. So it's just the way banking is today. You really have to be very active if you want to chase that highest rate. And in a rate environment like this, being active will pay off.
And the second point, just a quick one, the second question is, would you recommend property or shares for the current moment that we have, the current uncertainty at the moment that we have with today's market?
Yeah, look, unfortunately, no crystal ball, Will. It honestly depends what you're looking, what the purpose of the investment is, how you're going to structure the investment, how long you'll be holding the investment for, You know, there's so many things that go into that decision. And it's really just a property or shares question. I mean, you can buy shares in commercial property, for example, and commercial property outlook can be quite different to residential. You know, there's such a vast array of investments out there. So, look, I don't have a straight shares or property answer. I don't know, Phil, if you're willing to back a horse in this one.
Not really, but look, to boil it down simply, if you just listen to the news, you know that all the talk is about the Sydney property market, I guess, being hot and the share market not. So I'd be looking to buy into a market that's down in value, not up significantly. So I would have thought that shares would be trading at cheaper values than the property market at the moment.
But in terms of the property market, when would you think it'll cool down? How would you see the future?
With the property, I mean, yes, Sydney may be hot. There's plenty of, look at Perth. Perth is a pretty deflated market at the moment as well. So, yeah, you just need to be a bit cautious with that. But I would say when interest rates start going up, we will see some downward pressure on the property market simply because borrowing will become more expensive. You'll see some people come under pressure to maintain loan repayments, and that sort of interest will start to fall off.
All right, Will?
Yep, thanks very much.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for taking the time to call. 131-873. We'll have a little more after this. The clock has raced by. That felt very, very busy, wasn't it?
Very. It's good to hear a lot of callers.
Indeed. And, of course, if anyone wants to get in touch after the program, I won't be giving financial advice, but you guys can. The number for ITFS is
9258-7500.
Easy to remember. Have a lovely week. See you guys soon.
Thanks, Margaret.
We'll have open line in just a second. Before we get there, though, with IT Financial Service Course, you can look forward to a brighter financial future. IT Financial Services works with you in partnership to help you achieve your goals and to secure your financial future. Over almost 30 years, their advisors have helped literally thousands of people from all walks of life with everything from superannuation and investments to insurances and debt management. It is never too early to start your financial journey. Just make one call to IT Financial Services, as they said, the number 9258-7500, or go online, check out the website, itfs.com.au. That's at itfs.com.au to get started. IT Financial Services is Australia's own high-quality financial planning company. 9258-7500, of course, is the number. And the team from IT Financial Services joining us, every Tuesday morning, midnight till 1 a.m. We will be back after the news with all the open line. Plenty to talk about, opinion polls, stuff in America, heaps going on. 131-873.